This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Brosh.
Howdy, and welcome to another action-packed episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media at home on the range. I'm Paul Bishop, and next to me, drawing a mustache on his wanted poster, is my co-host Richard Prosh. How are you, pal?
Hey, I'm doing well, Paul, but I don't think this wanted poster looks anything like me.
That's because it's a wanted poster of the subject of today's episode, Jesse James.
Okay, that explains it. So 2 weeks ago, in part one of our On the Owl Hoot Trail with Jesse James episode, we put the murderous outlaw into his historic perspective, and in part two, we'll be talking about his impact on popular culture and how the legend of this notorious outlaw has endured.
However, before we get to our feature, I'd like to talk about something I've been up to recently.
Go for it.
But first, do you know the difference between in-laws and outlaws?
Tell me.
Outlaws are wanted.
Oh, man. So how long have you been keeping that groaner in cold storage looking for the right time to let it out?
Yeah, pretty much since we started the podcast.
So let's move on.
A few weeks ago, I was talking with our buddy Eric Compton over at Paperback Warrior. He has recently been putting his fairly large paperback collection into clear plastic archival bags. He gave me the Amazon links to the various size bags, and I have been steadily working my way through my bookshelves, putting books in bags.
That sounds like a never-ending task.
You got that right, and it takes forever, because I keep stopping to browse through the books I'm supposed to be bagging.
And I'll bet you're finding books that you forgot you even had.
Absolutely. I'm like, I want to read this, and I want to read this, and oh yeah, I want to read this. Frankly, it's exhausting, and it's all Eric's fault.
So did anything in particular come out of your bagging activities?
Some minor observations. As you know, I cull my library fairly frequently. From back in the day when I had 6,000 books on the shelves and stacked up everywhere else, I've whittled that down over the years to around a more manageable 1,500.
How do you choose what to pass on to the friends of the library or somewhere else?
Mostly, as I change genre reading habits, I usually pass on all but a hardcore 100 to 200 books from a specific genre, such as mystery, fantasy, boxing fiction, YA fiction, those things that I'm no longer specifically focused on.
You've been into Westerns for a long time, so are you keeping those?
Yes and no. Going through and doing the bagging, I came across a ton of Westerns that I know I'm never going to read. So I did cull out a lot of those, but I came across even more I'd forgotten I had and really do want to read, or that have got such cool cover art I'm not going to let them go.
It's kind of funny how that happens.
Yeah, I have several complete collections from my favorite old school Western authors like John Benteen, Frank O'Rourke, Frank Gruber, Louis B. Patton, and of course Louis L'Amour. I've also got full runs of more contemporary Western wordslingers like Ralph Compton, including new books written under Compton's brand. Then there's Ralph Cotton, who, after a long hiatus, has some new books scheduled for publications, and Charles G. West. But here's the thing. I keep these books because I can pick up almost any novel by these guys and know I'm in for a good read. They are solid and at times inspired wordslingers.
I agree with that.
So, while bagging these books from my collection, I couldn't help but choose one from each author to read. I want to single out one of the original Compton books, Dawn of Fury, written by the man himself. It's the first in a trilogy. The other two are The Killing Season and Autumn of the Gun, each one running about double the page count of most of his books. However, that isn't to say there's any fat in the stories. As you know, I'm not a fan of what we refer to as doorstop books, but Dawn of Fury kicks ass from start to finish. The story of Nathan Stone's journey from the tragedies of the Civil War to his path to becoming a fast-gunned legend and the toll it takes, it's hardly an original plot, but Compton makes the whole thing go down as smooth and tasty as a chuck wagon stew. If any listeners haven't read Compton before, I'd recommend Dawn of Fury as a good place to start.
I'll need to give that a try myself.
You won't be disappointed.
So did you finish all your bagging?
Not even close. I'm at the why did I start this point, and I'm no longer talking to Eric Compton, who probably just told me he was bagging his books knowing he would suck me in, but never actually did it himself.
He's probably laughing at you right now.
Best to ignore the situation, otherwise it will just encourage him.
In that case, why don't we let loose the cattle and get on with part two of our feature on Jesse James.
Rich, in part one, you shared several stories of, I guess you would call it, your 6 degrees of separation from Jesse James, as you've come into contact with the legend in the areas around Missouri where you live. But there was one I asked you to save until part two, because it speaks directly to Jesse James's impact even on that most innocuous area of popular culture, the TV sitcom. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. It's funny, no pun intended, how sitcoms can make real statements about serious issues mixed in with the humor. And I think the best sitcoms from our television history do that. You know, if you think about the favorites that you have and the episodes that endured, there's usually something a little bit more to them. And in this case, along with my encounters with Jesse James in comic books and that Bloomfield Diamond Jubilee album, I was actually one of the nationwide TV audience the night of February 2nd, 1973, when ABC aired an episode of The Brady Bunch called Bobby's Hero.
We've talked about dozens of Western television programs on the podcast, but other than a few Western comedies like F Troop, we rarely mention the word sitcom. It's not exactly the first TV show genre to be associated with Westerns.
I agree, but like so many late 60s, early 70s shows, The Brady Bunch was something I watched with my mom, and it was one of those rare shows that we both got something out of. The Bobby's Hero episode was especially meaningful for me, as it perfectly frames the intersection of Western legend, which, you know, I was watching on The Rifleman and shows like that, and the reality that I was living. So in the 17th episode of season 4, Mike and Carol Brady are called into the principal's office at school to discuss a problem with their 11-year-old son, Bobby. Asked to write a composition on a historical figure that he admires, Bobby chose Jesse James. The principal, Mr. Hillary, is concerned about the content of the report, but even more so, in a scene that we could replay today in our schools, he displays a cap gun confiscated from Bobby. The kid's been staging mock robberies on the playground, pointing the gun at people in imitation of his hero.
How prescient is that?
Yeah, no kidding. You know, I mean, in today's zero-tolerance society, that would not go over at all, and I think Bobby'd be in more trouble than he was then. Mike talks to Bobby about it, though, and he finds out that the kid sees Jesse as a folk hero, comparing him to Robin Hood. And I gotta tell you, Paul, in all the different resources that I've found, whether it's the back of a novel, the afterword from certain authors on some of the fiction that we've been reading, I have seen that comparison to Robin Hood written out just that way probably 36 times.
Over and over and over.
It's really weird.
I agree. It's just an oddball situation. So continue with the Brady Bunch episode.
So when Mike is talking to Bobby and he compares Jesse James to a folk hero, Mike says, no, Jesse James was a criminal. Throughout the episode, Bobby's infatuation grows despite him reading nonfiction books on Jesse's exploits and despite watching old movies. I admire the producers of the episode for including a scene where, with parental guidance on hand, Bobby watches an old black and white movie called Jesse James on the Vengeance Trail. It's apparently well known for its bloody violence on The Late Show. Much to Mike and Carol's dismay, the network has cut the most violent scenes where Jesse kills several occupants of a train. Well, this alerted me at an early age to beware of judicious edits. I actually spent years when I was younger believing Jesse James on the Vengeance Trail was a real movie outside of the Brady Bunch universe. But alas, we'll never see it because it only exists in co-writer Sherwood Schwartz and Michael Morris's imaginations. Anyway, Bobby eventually learns the truth about his hero when Mike arranges a meeting with a local author named Jethro Collins. Collins has penned a book entitled The Real Jesse James, and he ought to know because Jesse shot his father in the back during a train heist.
Ooh.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how you look back on these older sitcoms. Here's a guy whose father could have actually known Jesse James. They were that close in history.
This is a great setup for the episode. I mean, it's really pertinent, and we see this over and over again. As you said, Jesse James being described as a Robin Hood, almost every source uses that term, and it's completely false.
It really is, and the character of Jethro Collins really makes it clear to Bobby. Collins is played to perfection by the truly great character actor Burt Mustin, who, after the age of 67, took up acting and appeared in more than 150 TV and film productions. Colin's somber reflection on Jesse James spark a horrific dream sequence for Bobby. In his nightmare, the Bradys are riding a train and Jesse shows up. At first, Bobby is naturally eager to befriend his hero, but then Jesse kills the entire family before Bobby's horrified eyes.
Wait a minute. This is on network television in primetime for kids, and we've just seen the entire Brady Bunch family slaughtered.
Seriously, it's not your typical Brady Bunch episode. Jesse James was played here in this scene by Gordon Duvall, the son of Frank Duvall, who composed the Brady Bunch music. Duvall does a good job with the limited material he's given, perfectly playing the man who Jethro Collins described as a mean, dirty killer. Naturally, Bobby wakes up, finally realizing the truth about Jesse James.
Rich, your experience is a really good example of the cultural quirk in the American psyche, which can become infatuated by rebels, outlaws, and even killers. Jesse James himself is credited with saying, "All the world likes an outlaw. For some damn reason, they remember him."
We do see this over and over with characters who have become larger than life. Jesse James is just one example of a long list that include the likes of Billy the Kid, John Derringer, Bonnie and Clyde, many other violent criminals.
When we talk about this between ourselves, for lack of a better term, we've actually been referring to it as Robin Hood syndrome, which I've maintained may be connected to an individual's feelings of disenfranchisement or low self-esteem. However, as I've thought about it since last episode, I also think part of it comes out of our innate American ideal of individualism.
I can see that. However, in the case of Jesse James, I believe he understood how disgruntled people in the South were at the end of the Civil War, and how disenfranchised they felt, because he felt that way deeply himself.
Yeah, I agree, and I'll take that thought a step further and say he consciously took advantage of those feelings to make his actions palatable to many who still supported the Confederacy.
He certainly appealed to their sense of what they thought was justice. They may have lost the war, but the murderous actions of Jesse James and his gang helped them vicariously deal with their continuing anger and resentment toward the North.
And the Union soldiers certainly didn't shy from taking their own anger out under the color of authority. And the North also had their share of their own renegades who continued to commit atrocities in the name of the Union.
It's fairly easy to see then how the hero worship of Jesse James took hold.
Which is as good a jumping off point to do a deep dive into how Jesse James has been portrayed in popular culture. Let's start with a book and a movie which both you and I have a hard time liking.
The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford is one of the more recent and most popular novels on the life of Jesse James. Written by Omaha, Nebraska native Ron Hansen and published in 1983, the novel received fair reviews, with some readers taking issue with Hansen's almost documentary film-style approach to prose fiction.
It always surprises me when a critically acclaimed movie hits the top 10 list, and I learn the book it's based on is older than my grandchildren.
It gives us writers hope, I suppose. But in this case, I wonder what spurred Warner Brothers in 2004 to produce the then 20-year-old book.
The novel weaves a fictitious narrative through the historical details of brothers Jesse and Frank James's life, including their guerrilla warfare tactics during the Civil War and their life afterwards as train robbers. Along the way, they meet Charlie and Robert Ford, who are recruited into the gang. Hansen portrays Bob Ford as a whiny, fawning boy obsessed with Jesse's celebrity status. In fact, fame and infamy are central themes to both book and movie. After the compelling murder scene where Bob kills Jesse from behind, denying the deed a few minutes later as he escapes the James' home through a window, the book focuses on the Ford brothers' lives as notorious and publicly ostracized villains.
All but forgotten, the book was, as I said, adapted for a movie released in 2007 starring Brad Pitt as Jesse James and Casey Affleck as Robert Ford. Directed by Andrew Dominik and produced in Canada, the film opened to good reviews, did well at the box office, and scored a good many awards and nominations. While maybe not a complete scene-by-scene reproduction of the novel, the screenplay never strays too far away from the book, in narrative as well as tone. I kind of think that's my problem with it. I found both the book and the movie to be compelling, but both are longer than necessary. They're artistically sound, I guess, but as boring as watching paint dry, in my opinion. But that's just me.
How did you really feel about the play, Mrs. Lincoln? You know, I'm just not a fan of cinematic tricks like the sepia tone color schemes, the blurry scene edges, the time-lapse bits. Stuff like that can be fine in short films, but here, it just always seemed pretentious and jerked me out of the narrative.
A trade paperback version of the novel was reissued to coincide with the movie and includes an interview with the author and an essay about fact and fiction in the novel. These two works at the end were immensely more interesting to me than the actual dry narrative of the novel. In the interview, Hansen reveals that he smokes cigars while writing and he loves golf. He once worked for the Omaha Public Power District and had, at the time, exactly one short story published. These bits of trivia about the author were more exciting to me than the book. Might say something about the book, or maybe it just says something about me.
I'm with you. Despite good reviews for both the book and the film, as a reader and a viewer, I personally can't recommend either one. Another anomaly for me when it comes to making Jesse James a hero is the two-season ABC TV series The Legend of Jesse James, starring Christopher Jones as Jesse and Alan Case as his brother Frank. In an unsurprising twist, Jesse and Frank come across as good guys as they go about their outlaw ways. Jesse is a devilish scoundrel with an eye for the ladies, while Frank concerns himself with more practical matters. The show capitalized on lead actor Christopher Jones being a dead ringer for James Dean, giving the show a whole Rebel Without a Cause vibe. With a running time of 30 minutes and filmed in black and white for season 1 and in color for season 2, the series ran for 34 episodes from September 1965 to May 1966, and is notable for the appearance of Charles Bronson in one episode as a character named Cheyenne, and the line from the schmaltzy theme song, "The lasting fame, the lasting shame of the man with the hungry gun."
Oh, man.
They were reaching for that one, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. Starting with 1908's The James Boys of Missouri, by my count, there have been over 60 films either specifically about Jesse James or involving him as one of the major characters, such as Quantrill's Raiders.
There are two interesting things to me about Quantrill's Raiders, and neither of them have anything to do with Jesse James, actually. The first is actor Leo Gordon's scenery-chewing, scene-stealing performance as Quantrill. Gordon specialized in psychotic villains, and here he dominates the movie with a full-blooded performance, which makes the film worth watching despite its creative history. Second is, unlike Jesse James, Billy the Kid, and so many other murderous outlaws, Quantrill has never been given a revisionist resurrection. Instead, Quantrill has been demonized, rightfully, in every movie or book in which he appears. Apparently, history and pop culture have accepted that the butcher William Quantrill was the devil incarnate without a single saving grace.
In Jesse James and the Movies, Johnny D. Boggs writes, "Jesse James, 1939 with Tyrone Power and Henry Fonda, redefined how Jesse was portrayed. He went from thug outlaw to farm boy turned to crime by corrupt banks and railroads, a flawed hero for the common man."
There's that hero thing again. But Boggs's book is the definitive source when it comes to Jesse James' appearance on the screen, both large and small. Boggs analyzes the plots and players of more than 40 motion pictures featuring Jesse James, but the worth of the book is the comparisons between the Hollywood Jesse James and the hard facts of history.
Frank and Jesse from 1995, starring Rob Lowe and Bill Paxton as the outlaw brothers, is another revisionist take, portraying Jesse as a Robin Hood.
What a surprise.
A good boy forced by circumstances to follow a criminal life.
You probably could have guessed that simply by the film's taglines. Bad is good again. Sometimes the wrong side of the law is the right place to be. The Civil War made them outlaws. The people made them heroes. I mean, come on.
Just a couple of boys, never meaning no harm. The movie does get good performances out of Rob Lowe and Bill Paxton as the title characters, who are at the heart the screenplay's themes of brotherhood, kinship, friendship, and the atrocities not of the James brothers, but, of course, the evil railroads.
So basically, like so many other films involving Jesse James, it not only refuses to acknowledge actual historic events, but twists itself into an awkward justification for violence and murder.
True. The best part of Frank and Jesse are the train robberies, which are spectacularly shot action set pieces and violently realized. They make the film worth watching, despite its historical inaccuracies.
There are many other films involving Jesse James, varying watchability, including 1940's The Return of Frank James with Henry Fonda and Gene Tierney. Looking back in retrospects, critics wanted to have it both ways as far as this film is concerned. They acknowledged it's the least accurate, but at the same time arguing it's the best movie ever made about the James brothers due to its sense of character truth.
Ah, character truth, whatever that may be.
It's an amorphous statement, isn't it? Which makes it typical of a certain brand of professionally pretentious film reviewers.
Those critics have also shown a lot of love for I Shot Jesse James, filmed in 1949 by Samuel Fuller with Preston Foster and Barbara Bertin, and for The True Story of Jesse James, featuring the interesting casting of Robert Wagner and Jeffrey Hunter, with Hope Lang and Agnes Moorehead along for the ride.
1972's The Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid is notable for Robert Duvall's almost apostle-like portrayal of Jesse James, playing off Cliff Robertson's nuanced performance as Cole Younger.
The Last Days of Frank and Jesse James stars Kris Kristofferson as a surprisingly good Jesse James and Johnny Cash in one of his better performances as Frank James.
When we say surprisingly good, we mean his performance was surprisingly good. It's not surprising that Jesse James displayed as good. I always think made-for-TV movie when it comes to Kristofferson and Cash. I'm surprised Willie Nelson wasn't along for the ride.
Exactly. The movie's not really held in high regard, except for its historical accuracy, sticking to the facts with only a very few instances of dramatic license.
As far as the historical accuracy goes, it's one of those things where it's the difference between based on a true story and inspired by a true story. Neither of them are the true story, but based is a little bit closer than inspired by.
Yes.
And for a film that gets as far from the facts as possible, there's Jesse James meets Frankenstein's daughter from 1966.
You're kidding me.
Nope. Double billed with Billy the Kid versus Dracula, Jesse James and his dim-witted sidekick Hank are on the run from Marshall McPhee after a botched bank robbery. Seeking refuge and medical assistance, they hide out in the castle of Baron Frankenstein's granddaughter Maria, who can't wait to transform the hunky Hank into a lumbering zombie with a synthetic brain she wants to call Igor.
Tell me this isn't as bad as it sounds.
Surprisingly, it really isn't, if you have minimal expectations and a juvenile sense of humor. It's definitely a B-minus Western, crossed with the standard Frankenstein horror tropes, but it moves along briskly. There's some amusing one-liners, Indians attack, shootouts, and all the cool-looking lab gizmos associated with any Frankenstein outing. So if I'm picking this one as my favorite Jesse James movie, what's yours?
Despite its somewhat sentimental treatment of the outlaws, I'm going to have to be a little more traditional and go with 1980's The Long Riders.
Great choice, but the tagline definitely sets the tone of the film. They were nine men from four families. They rode together from Missouri to Minnesota and from Texas to Tennessee. This is their story, and it's as close to the truth as legends can ever be, which means it's not even inspired by a true story. No, I'm just...
as close to the truth as a lie can ever be.
There you go.
Well, maybe calling it as close to the truth as legends can ever be is pushing things, but the film's strongest and most alluring moments come from casting real-life acting siblings, James and Stacy Keach, as Jesse and Frank James, respectively. David, Keith, and Robert Carradine as Cole, Jim, and Bob Younger, respectively. Dennis and Randy Quaid as Ed and Clell Miller, and Christopher and Nicholas Guest as Charlie and Bob Ford. That's pretty inspired.
Yeah, sort of an outlaw version of Band of Brothers.
Exactly. But while this might be considered a gimmick, a version of what in television is called stunt casting, their performances are spot on with a tight script and absolutely brilliant directing by action auteur Walter Hill.
Hill is one of my favorite directors. He is often criticized for choosing style over content, but for me, he's in a class of his own. I love the awesome gun-toting avalanche that is Extreme Prejudice, which is Hill's take on the modern Western, and then there's his neo-Westerns such as The Warriors and the absolutely amazing Streets of Fire.
Didn't he also write the script for Sam Peckinpah's The Getaway?
He did. Peckinpah is obviously his idol, because in all his movies he adds visual flourishes that are unsubtly reminiscent of Peckinpah's accomplishments. He also has an unbridled love for the Western, returning to the genre in some form again and again over the course of his career.
Despite Hill's love of stylized violence, there are very few gunfights in The Long Riders, which makes them even more powerful when they do finally occur.
For me, the film's take on the Northfield, Minnesota ambush is perhaps one of the greatest shootouts in the history of Western cinema.
Yeah, it's certainly up there with the finale of The Wild Bunch, with a great use of sound to make each bullet hit home with a stark sense of realism. It's almost nightmare-inducing.
I do think it's a great popcorn Western, maybe even to rival Tombstone.
You do love to dump us into the middle of controversy with statements like that, don't you?
It's definitely in my nature, but putting aside my inflammatory statement, like so much of what we watched or read in preparation for this episode, The Long Riders ends up colliding with itself at the crossroads of fact versus fiction.
Which is a good segue to author and historian Bill Markley, who really keeps the difficulty of separating fact from fiction in the forefront of his mind in his three-book Legendary West series from Two Dot Publishing. His books include Geronimo and Sitting Bull, Leaders of the Legendary West, Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, Lawmen of the Legendary West, and the book I read for this episode, Billy the Kid and Jesse James, Outlaws of the Legendary West. Paul, I've never written a review for only half a book, but in this case, I'm going to focus on Jesse today and save Markley's William Bonney chapters for another episode.
Sounds good.
If you'd like to learn more about the book in the author's own words, I'm happy to be sharing a visit with him this coming Wednesday on our Six Gun Justice podcast conversation. So born 12 years ahead of Billy the Kid, Jesse James fills up the early chapters of Bill Markley's side-by-side comparison of the two men, who he calls the gold standard of Wild West outlaws. You'd really think that after more than a century of research and dramatic interpretation, there'd really be nothing left to say about either character. But with Jesse James, Markley manages to pull out a kind of sense of humanity of the real man in ways I haven't seen before. It's a fine encapsulated biography and kind of put together within a careful context. Markley uses sidebars and asides to set the mood and historical context of the times and places where Jesse lived and worked. This includes a series of entertaining pieces such as Did Jesse and Billy Meet? And another, my favorite, about imposters and would-be claimants to Jesse's life after the fact, called Did Jesse James Live On? Comparing and contrasting his life not only with interspersed chapters on the Kid, but with the pre- and post-Civil War nation, Markley offers a remarkably clear interpretation of what made Jesse James tick. He does so with great sincerity and a lack of bias. I was pretty impressed. It's an enjoyable book for seasoned scholars and beginning historians alike. I would lean toward recommending it first and foremost as a straight-ahead introduction to Jesse's life and career. Along with some additional commentary from Johnny D. Boggs, the book's afterword deals with many of the same media depictions of Jesse that we're touching on today. I'm grateful to Markley for introducing me to the earliest ballad about the outlaw, a song called Jesse James, written by an unknown composer and first recorded in 1919 by Bentley Ball. Since then, it's been covered by Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, the Kingston Trio, Van Morrison, Bob Seger, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Sons of the Pioneers, Johnny Cash, and even Bruce Springsteen on his 2006 album, We Shall Overcome, the Seger Sessions.
Jesse James is so deeply rooted in American culture, he has been musically memorialized or eulogized again and again. The Legend of Jesse James is a concept album documenting his life. It features Levon Helm, Johnny Cash, Charlie Daniels, and Emmylou Harris, among others. Written by Paul Kennerly, it was originally released in 1980. Americana singer-songwriter Ricky Jean Wright wrote the ditty Frank and Jesse James in 1982 while he was one of the weekly performers at the Mesquite Opry. The song tells of the effect the American Civil War had on the James brothers and their subsequent outlaw life, with the line, "It was all the same to Frank and Jesse James."
Robert Ford, Jesse James' killer, gets a number of mentions in various songs, including Robert Ford on the Stage, written by Australian singer-songwriter Dave Graney for his 1989 album My Life on the Plains, recorded with his group The White Buffaloes. The song is a potent evocation of Robert Ford's tortured psychological state after he killed Jesse James and the bizarre stage show he created with his older brother, which, as we mentioned, toured the countryside, enacting the events of how James was shot in the back by the man who once worshipped him as a hero.
Jesse even appears annually on the stage himself in the musical melodrama Jesse, written by Bob and Marion Moulton, with lyrics by Prairie Home Companion writer-performer Vern Sutton, and music by William Huckabee and Donna Paulson. Since 1976, the centennial of the James and Younger Gang's Northfield Bank Raid, the play has been traditionally performed in Northfield, Minnesota, during the town's annual Defeat of Jesse James Days.
Jesse James has also made numerous appearances in the comics, including a long-running series in the 1950s from Avon Comics, as well as a number of one-off appearances anytime a comics writer needed a time-traveling villain to cause an uproar. AC Comics published a very good collection, reprinting classic stories from the Avon series, which is still available. There are tales by a number of Golden Age legends, along with art by Everett Raymond Kinsler, Leonard Starr, Joe Kubert, and Wally Wood.
We talked earlier about the TV show The Legend of Jesse James. It also spawned a one-off TV tie-in comic from Dell. And then there's a strange anomaly of a movie tie-in for the movie Jesse James, which was published in England only. But my favorite Jesse James comic is the 1969 entry in the Lucky Luke series, which I've spoken about before, created by French artist Morris and writer René Goscinny, the co-creator of Asterix. In this one, Lucky Luke confronts Jesse James, his brother Frank, and Cole Younger, deftly skewering the image of Jesse James as a new Robin Hood. Jesse does indeed steal from the rich, who are logically the only ones worth stealing from, while he and his gang take turns being poor, thus being able to keep the loot from themselves.
There are so many novels in which Jesse James is either the focus or at least a major character. Like the movies featuring Jesse James, we can't possibly cover them all, but let's talk about a few of our favorites.
Sounds good. Go ahead and start us off.
For me, the gold standard of Jesse James fictionalizations is Northfield by Johnny D. Boggs. The prose here is delightful and spare, carrying the reader along through a tale of near epic scope, the planning, execution, and failure of the Northfield, Minnesota bank robbery on September 7, 1876. Boggs uses a wonderful literary device, chapters narrated by the historical characters involved, advancing the narratives through first-person accounts. More than most Western novels, this allows for a robust scope of action and ideas in a slim volume. Weighing in at only slightly more than 200 pages, Northfield has the feeling of a fast-action paperback of the Fawcett Gold Medal days, but with the depth of history usually reserved for nonfiction work. I especially enjoyed Johnny's afterword, where he lists his primary sources, books ranging from Jesse's son's autobiography in 1899, all the way to contemporary visits to St. Joseph and the friends of the James Farm.
I've got several Jesse James books I want to mention. The first is The Life, Times, and Treacherous Death of Jesse James by Frank Triplett. A first edition of this tome, originally published in 1882, was recently bought at auction for over $5,000. Triplett was a mining engineer and an author who wrote the book in 7 weeks immediately following Jesse's assassination. Accompanying the book's publication was a letter of authorization signed by both Jesse's wife and his mother, attesting to the authenticity of the book. For this reason, some historians credit it as the definitive biography of Jesse James. But while it claims to detail every one of the robberies and acts of violence Jesse and his gang perpetrated, it's pure hokum, full of bad grammar, hyperbole, and exaggeration. It's as clearly self-serving as the newspaper articles written with Jesse's approval while he was alive. I have no proof, but I do have a sneaky suspicion this book was in the works with Jesse's verbal input well before his untimely death.
At least it was untimely for Jesse, but I'm sure there were those who thought his death was very timely.
Well, there is that point of view. Comparatively, my favorite novel about Jesse James is Death of a Legend by Will Henry, whose books I've lauded endlessly in prior episodes. This is a warts-and-all unmasking of Jesse James, the folk hero, revealing him to be little more than a sordid sociopath serial murderer. Henry tells the tale in straight-ahead prose without sensationalizing his subject, nor demonizing him, instead letting the documented actions of Jesse James speak for themselves.
Max McCoy's Jesse, a novel of the outlaw Jesse James, is notable for its take on the rumors that Jesse James survived the assassination attempt by Robert Ford and told the tale to none other than Missouri's other famous son, Mark Twain. Oh, okay. Max McCoy is an award-winning novelist and investigative reporter, And here he presents a captivating story of switched identities and fractured morality that puts a surprising new spin on the misleading legend of America's Robin Hood. You know, Paul, I don't know what to think about things like this, because on the one hand, I think as a writer, wow, that's genius, right? To put Jesse James and Mark Twain together. On the other hand, it's so hokey that I just immediately lose respect for the whole thing.
It's kind of cringe-inducing in some ways, but, you know, it's brilliant. And if it's well told, then you got to give the writer some credit.
Absolutely.
The final Jesse James novel I want to talk about is by our Sixth Gun Justice deputy, Preston Lewis. And it's one of his books in his humorous, somewhat tongue-in-cheek H.H. Lomax series. In this case, The Redemption of Jesse James. This is really a coming-of-age story for a young Lomax, and it's told in typical humorous fashion. I'll do nothing more than give you the setup, in that everyone knows Jesse James was straightening a family photo on the wall when he was shot, but few realize that it was H.H. Lomax who bumped the wall in the first place.
For further reading about Jesse James, here are a few recommended titles to track down. Shot All to Hell, Jesse James, The Northfield Raid, and The Wild West's Greatest Escape by Mark Lee Gardner. Frank and Jesse James, The Story Behind the Legend by Ted P. Yateman. Jesse James Was His Name, or Fact and Fiction Concerning the Careers of the Notorious James by William Settlers. Jesse James, Last Rebel of the Civil War by T.J. Stiles. And The Lost Cause by James P. Muehlberger.
Well, partner, there's the clanging of the chuck wagon triangle telling us to wrap up our take on Jesse James with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Thanks to Mike Bray and Wolfpack Publishing for being our premier sponsor. Thanks to our other sponsors, author Chris Enns and the Western Writers of America. Thanks to Roundup Magazine and Saddlebag Dispatches for their support in promoting our podcast.
Next Monday, Rich will be joining me for another Six Gun Justice Speed Listen, featuring part two of our look at the history behind his new Western series, Hellbenders, all in under 15 minutes, give or take.
And in 2 weeks, we'll be back with episode 45 of the Six Gun Justice podcast, when we get back on the Owl Hoot Trail for part one of our take on Billy the Kid.
And don't forget our Six Gun Justice conversation segments every Wednesday, when either Rich or I get to hang around the Six Gun Justice Corral talking with writers and friends who love the Western genre as much as we do.
Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and keep your face off those wanted posters.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.